Hello and welcome to today's podcast, which is part of the Feminist Festival of Ideas, sponsored by the Gender and Society Research Hub at Northumbria University. I'm Mel Waters.
And I'm Victoria Bazin.
And we're going to be talking today about feminist periodicals. So I've been doing a little bit of work on the magazine Spare Rib, and Victoria, you've been looking at Shrew magazine. So both magazines that emerge out of the women's liberation movement, but both quite different
yes.
at the same time.
Yeah.
I wonder whether we might just start by saying something about these women's liberation periodicals. What does a women's liberation magazine look like?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, because it's hard to define them, to be perfectly honest about it. I mean, obviously, the British women's liberation movement dates from roughly the late 60s up to the mid to late 80s. So women's liberation periodicals are the magazines, newsletters, newspapers that were produced to circulate the debates taking place within the movement. Examples of those magazines might be Shrew, you've already mentioned Shrew that I'm working on, Catcall, Banshee, Red Rag, Jezebel, Scarlet Woman, Trouble and Strife, but of course, you know, Spare Rib was probably the most high profile of all those magazines and certainly had the highest circulation.
Yeah, so I think Spare Rib circulation is something like 20,000.
Mm.
I don't know about Shrew.
Yeah, it definitely varies. I know at the beginning of its life, in the late 60s, they're printing about 200 of the what are really no more than newsletters. But obviously, as the magazine develops, its circulation increases. So it does get higher than the 200 initially. But certainly 20,000 for Spare Rib, you know, indicates that it was a magazine read by quite a few people.
Yeah, although I don't think it was that easy to get a hold of, unfortunately. So although it's regarded as the mainstream women's liberation periodical, the one that you'll be able to find in the newsagents, a lot of the letters and the letters page indicate that people can't really find it.
Mm.
So I think they were quite reliant on subscriptions. You know, if you really wanted your copy of Spare Rib, then you needed to subscribe.
Yeah.
I don't know about what was the case with Shrew.
I think it's very similar, and one of the things that comes up in reading the actual newsletters in the early days is that the Women's Liberation Workshop, which is the group of women who get together in London to discuss feminist issues and to debate those issues, they often exchange periodicals with each other, and they use those workshops almost as libraries, circulating libraries.
Mm.
And so when you talk about circulation figures, and certainly historians of periodicals, when they're trying to assess how many people might have read a particular periodical, they generally times the circulation figure by 3, on the understanding that a lot of people might read the magazine without actually buying it or subscribing to it. So I think that's really interesting, and I think you can never really tell, in a sense, how wide the circulation might have been. And certainly you see lots of evidence to suggest that a lot of these women were in fact also getting magazines, periodicals from the United States as well, and
yeah.
that was really important.
You're just reminding me about a guy who wrote into Spare Rib actually and said, "Oh, I found a copy of your magazine in a skip." So I bet they haven't accounted for that in their circulation figures.
Yeah.
People might be picking their magazines out of bins.
Exactly, and just things like going to the dentist or the doctors, you know,
yeah.
you would be leafing through magazines, and it might be that sometimes the newsletter or some of these magazines might be left there, you know.
Yeah.
So it's hard to calculate those circulation figures. But I think it raises an interesting question about why we study these very low circulation magazines, because I mean, what was the circulation of something like Cosmopolitan at this time?
I think I read somewhere the first issue of Cosmopolitan, I think they printed 300,000 copies.
Right.
So
yeah,
we're
compare
talking about
that. Yeah.
A much wider readership
yeah.
than Spare Rib or Shrew.
Exactly. Exactly. So you might say, well, why read these magazines when so few people, comparatively speaking, would have been reading them at the time? But I think that actually there's all kinds of interesting things that come out of reading these magazines and exploring some of the debates that are taking place at the time in the late 60s, early 70s. For instance, I mean, I think it's important that many of the issues that are raised in the magazines actually haven't gone away.
Yeah, and also I guess a lot of those issues are also starting to appear in more mainstream press at the time as well. So it come the 1980s, magazines like Woman's Own are running lots of articles about working women and how to juggle your domestic responsibilities with going being out of the house all day. And also things like rape and incest start to kind of seep into the women's magazine like from the late 70s onwards. So these smaller magazines were having a big impact on the media landscape at the time, the kinds of issues that they thought women were interested in.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important, that idea that there are networks, periodical networks, and actually, you know, those big mainstream sort of blockbuster magazines are actually drawing on some of these small circulation magazines for some of the issues and ideas that are in circulation in those smaller magazines. So as you say, they did have an impact in terms of raising awareness about issues that women were debating and discussing at the time.
So in the case of Shrew, are there particular issues that the magazine is interested in and that it keeps returning to?
Definitely. I mean, you know, it's difficult to generalise because every newsletter, every magazine is slightly different. Each magazine was produced by a different collective in London, working in London. So each magazine has its own distinct character.
So Shrew isn't produced by the same set of people every month?
No, it's not. It's a group of different collectives that originated in North London, and then, you know, the collectives kind of expanded beyond London. And they all had their own agendas, basically, and their own sort of interests that they wanted to pursue. So it's sort of interesting in terms of how it was put together from that point of view. And in the early days, it was really, I mean, the one thing that comes up most often in the early days is the Miss World protest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is really, really interesting to kind of hear, almost to feel that you're hearing first-hand accounts of the protests.
Yeah. Because a lot of those women were involved in the Miss World protest directly.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. So they were involved in kind of mobilising other women because obviously they had a newsletter in circulation. It was a great way of getting women involved, informing them of the meeting times and, you know, what kinds of clothes they should wear. For instance, they talk about dressing up in order to get into the Albert Hall so that they don't look conspicuous, so that they're not barred entry. So that's really interesting.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, so they go in covert, as it were, and inside their handbags were kind of bags full of flour and eggs, etc., you know.
Wow. Oh, that's Sally Alexander and that group of feminists.
Yes. Yeah. So, but also what comes out of that in the wake of the protest, what's really interesting is the debate that emerges about the relationship that feminism has to the media, and whether or not those women should court publicity, or whether they should actually have nothing to do with the mainstream press. And what happens in subsequent newsletters is certain women actually analyse reports about the Miss World protest.
So there's a feminist discourse analysis of the media fallout.
Yeah. And it is really interesting that in particular one of the women, in her critique, she points out that most of the coverage focuses on, ironically, how the feminists look, you know. So the focus is on their long hair and their maxi coats, you know, which is quite interesting. And she says, look, you know, if we're going to pose for the cameras, this is how we will be co-opted by the mainstream press. You know, we will be objectified as women. We won't be able to resist that. So she, you know, there's an argument in favour of courting publicity, and then there's an argument that says no, we should, you know, just we should just refuse to engage with the mainstream media altogether.
Is there advertising in Shrew? Are they? They're not. they're not reliant on advertising for their revenue or
not in the early days. Towards the end of Shrew's life, which is about 1978, I think.
Yeah.
There are not exactly advertisements, but there are ads for things like just feminist bookshops and feminist books, that sort of thing. So yeah. I think there's a promotion of feminist culture, but there's not paid advertising, you know.
Because that's one of the very awkward things about Spare Rib, is that it was set up on a shoestring. I think they had £3,000 initially for their startup costs. But then they are somewhat reliant on advertising. And the question then becomes, who do you allow to advertise in a feminist magazine? So you've got, first of all, the editors asking this question, but then you also think the advertisers must also be wondering what kinds of products the feminist might consume. So there's some quite odd adverts that crop up. There's an advert for this men's aftershave called Sabre, and it's like for adventurous men only. So that's one of the like full page ads that they must have sold. And then there are other things that you would probably be less surprised to find there. There's the Department of Health take out a full page ad to warn pregnant women about the dangers of smoking to the unborn baby. But that creates a storm of controversy, because the advert depicts a naked and pregnant woman in profile. So the editors are then slammed for kind of perpetuating these sexed up images of women.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they really can't win. Whatever they're doing, it's somebody's upset.
So there's a sort of ambivalence about consumer culture, but at the same time a recognition that there has to be an engagement with consumer culture.
Even some of the people who are complaining about it say, we're so grateful that Spare Rib exists, it's a really important magazine, but can you please not publish sexist adverts? There's a really weird ad, actually, of it's advertising a Dana Gillespie album, and she's all like trussed up in stockings and suspenders, a little sort of basque, and it's a full page ad, so it's quite full on, and it seems really incongruous in the context of the magazine, of course. But Spare Rib print an accompanying statement saying that Dana felt empowered by this image, and it was her decision to appear in this way. So there's already the emergence of what we think of now is that the post-feminist debates about choice and empowerment and how women choose to present themselves within media culture.
It's really, really interesting. And it's so often, I don't know if you found this with Spare Rib, but so often I'm reading articles and I'm seeing the ways in which those articles, obviously, as you say, anticipate debates that, you know, they're ongoing. We're still having particular, you know, certain kinds of debates. But also I think, you know, you can see the ways in which some things have shifted, at least. I'm thinking about an article about advice given to pregnant women, you know, and it's about what to do when you go into hospital and how to sort of basically take charge of the whole process of giving birth, which I thought was interesting, you know. And I thought, given that, you know, there's much more interest in, you know, a birth plan and all that sort of thing, this was a sort of early version of, you know, make sure you write down your birth plan, it's that sort of thing.
So is there in that case a skepticism about expert culture and about the medical establishment? And because that comes up in Spare Rib quite
definitely,
a lot as well, that your GP might dismiss you as a hysterical woman, so that was a more general anxiety within the movement.
And I think the tone of this article, I have to read you some of it because it's quite interesting. She's very strident, and she tries to sort of communicate the importance of being assertive, which obviously when you're possibly feeling a little, I don't know, out of control, shall we say, vulnerable even, you know, she's trying to kind of get women to make sure that they express themselves clearly, and if they need something to say, that they need it. So she'll say, Don't believe everything you were told, especially before the birth. Obviously, that's good advice, we know.
Yes.
That. Yeah. During labour, if you feel in control, don't be afraid to show it. Don't let yourself be treated like a piece of meat. You know, delivery position and position during labour is usually ordained by hospital systems. If you want to take up a different position, then make a fuss about it. You know, just say, this is how you're going to do it. If you want to see someone, if you want to go out and smoke, she says, don't plead for it, you know. That won't get you far. Do it or demand it. Threaten to walk out if necessary.
I was going to imagine that. You know? Where are you going to go at that point? How about in a utility cupboard?
I know.
I love that. If you want to go out and smoke,
I know.
You can tell it's the 70s, isn't it? I think in these magazines you get a really strong, like, the 70s is not a long time ago, but it feels like another world.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yes, you do definitely feel like in another world, you know. There's so many things that come up that I think particularly because in terms of the fashion and the way they talk about beauty and fashion is it feels different. It's difficult to put your finger on it a little bit, but
there's initially quite in spare rib, there's a bit of a utilitarian approach to beauty whereby, right, like, the beauty page only lasts for a handful of issues. But it's very much about cleanliness, about keeping your pores sort of safe, really, from all the, like, pollutants in the atmosphere.
Mm, yes, yeah.
So it's much more practical than, yeah, it's not interested in, like, advertising particular cosmetics brands. Or with one exception, where they decide that they're going to make over a man. So they do the classic women's makeover on this unsuspecting bloke, or suspecting probably. So they don't just sort of take him for a facial and, like, do his hair. They stick loads of makeup on him as well. He's got mascara and lip gloss, bit of blusher. It costs £13 as well, which seems to have provoked the most outrage, the cost of all this makeup. But it's really interesting as well. It's quite a tongue-in-cheek article. And it's the kind of article that disappears once the magazine becomes more confident in its agenda. But it is funny. Like, at the end, the guy says, wow, is it really me? Like, am I this handsome? But it does also the serious work of exposing how these beautifying rituals have become a matter of course for women. But it appears absurd when, you know, a man's put through the same kind of process.
And I think that sort of ambivalence about things like makeup and fashion, yeah, even in the newsletters in for Shrew in the early years, that comes across quite strongly. And I think we were talking about this before. What I find really interesting and actually really refreshing is that you always get a sense of debate, even conflict, you know, contestation, you know. Yeah. You don't get one view dominating a lot of the time, you know. You get a sense of these women actually engaged in dialogue with each other, and sometimes just agreeing to disagree. There's a sort of discussion about makeup where you see that, you know, where, yeah, women are adopting very, very different positions with regards to makeup. And I really enjoyed reading those different perspectives and those points of view.
It's difficult to know where you would see that kind of debate now.
Yeah.
If we're looking at the changes in the media landscape from the 1970s and up to the present day, then I'm not sure where you go for that kind of debate. Which magazines you open and find a discussion about the pros and cons of makeup in any sort of political context.
I think that's right.
It's gone.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think a lot of the magazines and a lot of the media in general is like this. So there's a very strong kind of editorial, it's a very strong sort of editorial feel to it, so that there's a particular image, or you might describe as a kind of USP associated with that particular magazine.
Yeah.
And it conveys a particular image. and it never really sort of transgresses from that image, you know. Whereas the newsletters, there's not that sense of trying to kind of get across one particular image of feminism, or one particular set of ideas or ideals. Even though a lot of those women have very kind of deep sort of political convictions, they're still trying to work out how to communicate those. And that's, again, another thing that sort of fills the pages of the newsletter. You know, how are we going to communicate this without stifling debate?
I think that's right, and I think that's one of the important things about these magazines, is that they're trying to work out all the time what a women's liberation magazine should look like. Mm. You know, do we have advertising? If we have advertising, what kind of advertising should it be? What do we say about the way women look? Do we have articles on fashion? Women wear clothes, but what kind of clothes would a feminist wear? Mm. So there are all these things that see these periodicals trying to work out how they differ from the mainstream press, and I think that's where a lot of these debates have their origins, and these decisions about what women's liberation is.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to maybe the beginning of our conversation, which was about the relevance of these magazines and why it's important to read them, and why it's important to go back and kind of get into those debates. Because as one of the women in one of the magazines I was reading sort of points out, you know, we historians today will go back to the mainstream newspapers and they'll take those accounts as being kind of the record of what happened. And that's obviously only one version. And when you look at these feminist magazines, you get a very, very different perspective. And if we don't go back to these magazines, we'll lose that perspective. It'll be as if there were no other voices sort of offering an alternative view of events such as the Miss World protest, for instance.
I suppose what we should say in rounding off is that if you're interested in women's liberation periodicals and feminist media, then it would be good for you to come along to the City Library in Newcastle on the 16th of March at 6:30. Although I believe if you come at 6, you might be treated to tea and cake as well. Because Victoria and I are going to be doing another talk.
And we'll be joined by Rosie Lewis from the Angelou Centre, who's also going to be talking about feminist magazines from the 70s. So hopefully we'll have a good audience, and we can open up the discussion to the audience, because we'd certainly like to hear about your views about women's magazines today and, you know, in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah. Okay, well, we hope to see you then.
Bye.
Bye.